Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, Beatles edition. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg. Hey, this is Ryan. Thank you so much for checking out the Songs of Note podcast. It has been so fun having a whole month of Beatles episodes. And so if you have missed any of the previous episodes, this is our fifth one. And all of these episodes are with author Colin Fleming, who is writing a book on the Beatles called Same Band You've Never Known, An Alternative Musical History of the Beatles. You can follow him on Twitter at Colin Fleming Lit, or online at his website is colinflemminglit.com. He is just a great writer, communicator, lover of music. And so it's been a real honor to have him on all these episodes. If you are liking the show, please take a minute and subscribe so you don't miss the future episodes. We hit on all kinds of different bands. So if you're just joining us for the first time, we've done episodes on, gosh, The Doors, Joy Division, Billie Holiday, just tons and tons of great bands. So we'd love for you to go back and check those out if you haven't heard them already. And we're doing Hey Jude today. So let's head on over to the interview with Colin now. All right, it's Ryan here. I have Colin Fleming. We are doing episode 5 of 5, the last of 5 episodes on the Beatles. Colin is writing a book called Same Band You've Never Known, An Alternative Musical History of the Beatles. Today is the last episode on Hey Jude, which I'm really pumped to talk about. Colin, thank you so much for taking time to chat about this song and this band so much this month. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, my pleasure.
Man, loved it. I've learned so much this month, and it's great, and it makes you appreciate the music more when you know more about it. So I'm grateful for your time and expertise on this band for sure. And we're talking about Hey Jude. So for people who don't know about Hey Jude, can you give us a little history? What's the song about? What are these lyrics about? Or the and kind of the background in writing the song with Paul McCartney.
So it was actually in late July 1968, so right as in we're taping this here in, what, July 27th? Mm-hmm. So McCartney played this for the first time for Lennon on July 26th, and the whole thing is going to go down pretty quickly in late July and early August. It's going to come out at the end of August, 68. Crazy, right?
That's
it's not
fast.
Crazy. It's like how it should be.
Yeah.
But now it's like you sell a book and then the book comes out like 2 years later. It's just like this kind of delay mm-hmm. with everything. And I always think to myself, like, we only live so long. Let's get this out there. Let's do this.
Right.
And so it was out there pretty quickly. And there is the whole biographical breakdown of how the song came to be written. And I don't think we should conflate that with what the song is about, because I think that's very limiting. But we can look at the actual backstory of how it just went down chronologically, biographically. Lennon had left his wife, Cynthia Lennon. And we had alluded to this, right, on an earlier podcast. And I think that wasn't like our prefatory remarks to each other. I think it was when we were actually like being recorded about how very difficult to read about the way Lennon treated Cynthia, right? Like,
right.
It's, I mean, there's cold and there's like, are you kidding me? Cold, right? Like, ice cube type stuff and almost a pathological coldness, I would say, to be that unfeeling towards someone else and like in their own home and everything. It really was quite this horrific violation. I guess that's really like a home, like an emotional home invasion is
like the,
what I would equate it to.
Totally. And like the scene that I'm thinking of, and I think it's the same one you're thinking of, is where Cynthia Lennon is married to John, and she leaves the house and comes back for the weekend and opens the door, and John and Yoko are both sitting on the ground in the dark or something wearing their robes. And you just envision it.
It's in a robe. Right. And it's even worse because she'd gone off on a trip with that dodgy character, Magic Alex, and the whole thing had been orchestrated. And Lennon's not even like, sorry, my bad, meant to tell you about this. He's just cold to her. Like, what's your problem? Almost type of thing. Like, if anyone who reads it, there's a good account for it in the tell-all. But it gets dismissed as this trashy tell-all book, The Love You Make, but I think it's the best Beatles biography out there. People want to say the Mark Lewisohn books, but to me, at the level of the sentence, he's just a horrible writer. I have a hard time reading him. But the Love You Make, really, and it captures this early on. It's kind of how the book begins. So what happens is Cynthia Lennon is isolated from her now former unit. These were people who were friends, the wives were friends, and no one would have anything to do with Cynthia Lennon except, to his credit, Paul McCartney would visit her, and he would try to cheer up her son, Julian. Lennon himself was horrible, too, and, like, writes out of his will. I mean, all this, like, imagine and all you need is love stuff. Maybe not so fast. And this was after, this is like in the 70s, too, when he's all, like, reformed and all of that. So to cheer up the lad, and who was born in, like, what, 63, right? Somewhere right around the start of when the Beatles made their kind of breakthrough, where they were moving towards America and that sort of breakthrough. And so that's why you have this quality with this song of, it's like a nursery rhyme, but it's like a lullaby. If you actually look at the lyrics, it's that same kind of, I don't know, what your mother sang to you when you went to sleep at night, right? Because that's how mothers are. Like, later in life, they're like, I used to sing this to you. You don't remember it when they sung it to you when you're, like, 3 months or whatnot. Like, I'm thinking of this now. I'm thinking of the things that, like, my mom that I know later, like, retroactively, I learned that she would sing to me. And it's always put me in mind of this song. So you have Julian, Jules, and then it's like a hop and a skip to Jude, which is a classical kind of English name, right? Yeah. Like, if anyone else out there is a literary person, a literature major, you'll Jude the Obscure and all of that. So it just fit well, and that's kind of the biographical backstory, which Lennon is going to misinterpret.
And so Lennon thought that the song was about him, is that right?
Yes, he thought it was. Now, what's interesting about, there are a lot of things interesting about this song, but there's this definite gay subtext. There is both a religious, spiritual Christ subtext to the song, and there's also this homoerotic subtext, which I find quite interesting. Lennon was taking this as McCartney expressing his consent, angle, to go out and be with this other person as his main person. And I think that's how we tend to align in this life. We have an island that we're on with our main person, and then we have our dependents and whatnot, and then we have our periphery people and other islands out there in the archipelago. But you have, like, your main person, and they were each other's main people for a long time, even though they were romantically involved with, certainly Lennon was married, and McCartney had his setup with Jane Asher and whatnot during the swinging London days. But the way Lennon heard this was, hey, go out there, do your thing. I understand this is your new person. Or maybe this was your person all along, and I was a stopgap, but I can be strong enough for that because I wanted to see you happy. And this was a time when these people were not happy with each other. They weren't wishing each other well, and they wanted nothing to do with one another.
And it's such a... It's such a happy song for all the terrible stuff that was going on between them internally. Don't you think it feels like it feels like such a joyous song, but like you said, they were kind of miserable people at this point in their career.
I've never thought of it as a joyous song.
Really?
I've thought of it as having joyous moments of musical expression.
Okay.
And it that would be to me like saying, I guess it depends how you define joyous. Like, would one define Thoreau's journals as joyous? They have this searching, questing quality. But let's just even look at the lyrics. Now, I don't spend a lot of time usually discussing lyrics because I think they're almost like a kind of happenstance. And they're chosen more for their sonic congruity rather than like what they're actually saying. Like,
agreed.
Even Dylan will go for the rhyme rather than the sense, right? So that's when people call Dylan a poet. It's like, no, he's not. He really isn't. Because if you divorce it from the music, it doesn't work. But let's look at the verbs. Now, verbs in literature, they power the sentence. Next time you're reading something, and it's really well written, note what the verbs are doing. Verbs are like crossovers when you're skating, where you go into this turn, you power through the turn, you accelerate in the turn, and you actually come out of the turn with more speed than you went into the turn. That's what a verb can be like. Look at the verbs in this song. Refrain, they're using the word refrain as a verb. Carry, go out and get them. Perform. Now, these are not like sort of happy-go-lucky, cherubic verbs.
That's true.
They are, to me, the verbs of the Book of Common Prayer, really. You'll find these as almost kind of like psalm verbs, right? They're the verbs of the psalmist.
Yeah.
And I don't think, although a psalm can be uplifting, right? You don't think of it as like, oh, this is really happy. Mm-hmm. It's not zippity doo-dah.
Right.
And so lullabies at the same time, they're often in this minor key. Now, they're not dirges because you don't want to give the little child nightmares, but it has the lullaby construction.
That's
true.
It's
this lulling into calmness. And so you have that going on, and it's going to build and build and build. And you're also, in the song, somebody is tasked with doing something arduous. This person has found you. You've had that fortune in life to have met this person, and they have, if we say someone's found us, they've extended some sort of effort to get into our skin, our lives. And then this person, and again, we come back to this idea of the letter song, which we have with She Loves You, and we talked about with Arthur Alexander. See how this all interrelates. This is what they got from Arthur Alexander, like we talked about last time. This person, the friend, same friend of She Loves You, maybe, grown up a little bit, now they're married with kids, is tasking their buddy with going out and being vulnerable with someone else.
Hmm.
Now, we fall into love, I get that, but there is also an element in love, true love, that is choice-based. You have to decide to extend yourself,
true,
to give yourself over to somebody else, to both enhance their growth and your growth. I think it's part of the reason we're so fractured right now, because we don't have the emotional courage or the wherewithal to do that.
Mm.
So that is what this, so you're setting out on a quest here with this song, and you might be able to realize the quest, but when you set out on the quest, right, like you're Odysseus, you're not like, well, this is going to be a piece of piss.
Mm.
This will be easy. So I think that sort of undercuts some of the sort of like outright joy.
That's fair. That's a very fair response. I guess, you know, when I think about this song, I think about the ending, the na 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 that goes on endlessly. And for me, that's like one of the happiest, like, feeling songs I can think of. It's not cheesy happy. It feels joyous. But certainly, you're right. The lyrics to the whole front end of the song are definitely not that. I guess my memory of this song is being in eighth grade in. You know, being in somebody's mom is driving us around after band practice, and we were cranking this, you know, singing as loud,
sure,
as we could. And that's the memory that sticks with me. So maybe I'm also intertwining my personal memory with it. But that's a good point on the lyrics. And it really,
and for me, it was ninth grade.
Mm, okay.
And I remember like the first like Beatles album. It's not even really an album that I had. And I was like at a hockey camp, like summer hockey camp. It's probably like now, all these like years ago, like 20 plus years ago. Yeah. And I had like the 20 greatest hits, and I always like was keen to get to the second side. I mean,
yes,
you really couldn't go wrong with anything on 20 greatest hits, except maybe The Long and Winding Road was kind of
okay,
down,
yeah,
at the end. I think that's the last song. And so Hey Jude, like it would be Hey Jude, and that moment in She Loves You, they have the chorus, and then there's going to be that sort of tumble of drums and those guitar notes, and then it explodes into the verse, which is weird because the song would normally explode into the chorus. Those are the two Beatles moments for me that produce a physical tingling sensation on my neck, mm, shoulders. Like they're tactile.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're somatic in the way that you feel them. You physically feel them.
Right.
And there aren't like a lot of moments that I've ever thought of that you like. We've talked about with the Sam Cooke, Live at the Harlem Square,
mm-hmm,
Club.
Yep.
Maybe Dylan before he does like a Rolling Stone at Manchester Free Trade Hall in May 17th, 1966. But these are the two Beatles moments for me, and especially too when they go into the coda at the end. But a lot of the coda is Paul McCartney's vocalizations.
Mm-hmm.
And what is he going to do next? And also, I think that they've earned the euphoria. It's almost like a metaphor. Like, you've done the hard work,
yeah,
of life.
That's good.
Of vulnerability. And now it's
here's
like
your reward.
Payoff, right?
Right.
Like you had a hard day's night. You worked your ass off this week. You worked 8 days a week. But like in this sort of emotional sense and in the wisdom sense of life.
Right.
These are people now who are, I don't necessarily know that they're smarter than they were a few years before, but because She Loves You is a very smart song,
mm-hmm,
but they're wiser,
yeah,
they're older, they're
more experienced,
they're more seasoned. So this, mm-hmm, is like, there's a lot of wisdom in She Loves You. Hey, love, She Loves You, it's like, buddy, you're blousing this up. This isn't going to go the way that I think you really want it to go in your heart if you keep behaving this way, which is a really mature conversation, really, for anyone to have, right? But here they are having a kind of version of that conversation in 1968, while in some ways also miscommunicating with each other, which is appropriate too.
Totally. Well, so I didn't know, this is my own ignorance, but I didn't know that this song was recorded in the middle of the White Album sessions. I had no, like, in my mind, this was after that. This is disconnected. But according to the timeline, this is in the middle, right?
Where else could it have been, though? Like, right? So it's after Pepper. Has to be, obviously, after Pepper. Yeah. And they're going from... Don't forget, let's even count Magical Mystery Tour. They're going from Pepper to... I mean, you have the White Album. But then after that, it's like a straight shot to Let It Be. And it doesn't have a Let It Be vibe at all, right? So... And I always think of this, and this is not a race thing, so people don't freak out at me. I always think of this as like a very white song. Mm. It's like, what I mean by that is, in terms of sounds have colors, right? Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, definitely.
And this to me is like a bar of immaculately white soap singing. Now, it doesn't mean that it's not soulful.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that there's not like an African American element or anything. It just means like notes have certain sonic coloristic property.
Yeah.
And that's what this is. So it to me, in that sense, even with that kind of play on colors, it logically fits with the whole White Album deal. And it really couldn't be. I mean, when I hear this song, I see white. I see, it's even like right from, first of all, when the way it starts, and this is something that I'm glad it comes up, because I mentioned it before when we were talking about the long medley on Abbey Road.
Yep.
It starts a cappella. It starts naked, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how the long medley on Abbey Road starts, with the Thomas Dekker poem, Golden Slumbers, where it's just McCartney's voice. And so that's almost like a blank piece of paper, right? That's sort of like the image in your mind. And then it's that first syllable. That first syllable of this song, hey, think about it. It achieves so much. And I don't even really mean the way he sings it. But like, for instance, if you're someone who's a writer and you don't write typically in subject-verb sentences, and most people write in subject-verb sentences, if you then, while you're doing your thing, begin with a sentence with subject-verb and you start with a the, which sounds like so basic, like who doesn't start a sentence with the? But if you don't do it that much and then you do it, it's like sticking your foot hard in the ground, like you're in football and you're going to come driving off the line. It's almost jarring that the. You can really just power so hard with a sentence starting with a the if you haven't had a lot of sentences prior to that to start with a the. Their hey is the equivalent of that the. But think about a hey. A hey is almost always like rude, right? It's not normally like a polite. You can't make a hey often sound friendly. The only time a hey sounds friendly is when you are having a deep heart-to-heart. You're at the hospital, right? Something happened to a family member. You're not doing well. Someone leans in close and says, hey, buddy, we'll get you through this. Right? That's when you do the hey. And so hey is also this crucial syllable in rock and roll history. Kansas City, hey, hey, hey. All of Little Richard's hey. It's like the go-to word.
Yeah.
So they're using that, they're repurposing it, right? They're recalibrating it, and it's just McCartney's voice alone. Hey, and it hangs in the air with all that breath, and it's like, oh, sold it. They've sold it in less than a note.
That's good. He sets the emotional mood of the song in just that note with that one word.
Yeah.
Man, that's cool.
It's like the fastest. It's one thing, so like you get in the NHL, everybody is like really fast. But the guys who are the best skaters, this is the thing. They are up at full speed after two strides. Other people take like, right, 10 to get going or whatever it is. Other people have, it's rare, instant acceleration. And McCartney as a singer, he has that in these two quite similar moments.
Yeah.
From kind of like the same time period. With the Abbey Road, the start of that long medley, and in here, like this is the one sets up the other, or however you want to look at it. But it's all coming off of that way he has, and there's so much breath in the word.
Yeah.
There's so much tone and solidity in the word, but he's also imbuing it with breath.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like cutting the word these two seemingly contrasting ways. He's getting so much leverage out of this word. He's getting sonic leverage. He's getting metaphorical leverage. He's getting philosophical leverage, right?
Yeah.
He knows what he has. And then it's like, it's just like one of the great single, maybe it's the best single starting syllable sung in terms of vocal quality in the history of popular music.
I can't think of a better one. I mean, I don't disagree. Because you can hear that one note and you know where you're going. You have that, you know, the temperature of the room that you're entering in with that note.
It's like we talked about Beethoven's Fifth before.
Oh, yeah.
How it begins with a rest. It begins with a rest.
Right.
You can't hear by definition the rest. Mm-hmm. And we talked about how the Beatles would use this construction of the audible rest. Here, mm-hmm. they're doing the audible rest, right? Because
right.
he's starting, it's almost like lifting the baton. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Hey, and everyone's like, okay, now they're going
and
to come down on
now.
The,
yeah.
Right, they're going to come down on that downbeat.
Yeah.
And think of, like, Lennon's guitar comes down on that downbeat. Now, his guitar is just chunka, 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 that acoustic guitar.
Right.
But it's really, like, in a sense, it's not more sophisticated than All Together Now. He's playing the same guitar. Like, you can hardly even hear George Harrison's guitar in this.
Right.
And he was angry.
Yep.
Because he had these ideas. He's like, I want to do this.
Well, he wanted to echo. Yeah, he wanted to echo McCartney's vocal with the guitar line or something, right?
Yeah. for a while.
Mm.
For like the first, before the coda, so like the first. But he would want to do things of that nature on songs where it just wouldn't. Strawberry Fields Forever was another one. And it was the same idea. He wanted to do that answering guitar lick. Here you would have done it 27 times though, and nobody would have wanted that. And it was very much a group performance, but it wasn't like a performance where there was a lot for maybe everybody. It's you know what it is? It's a sing-along.
Yeah.
It's a very sophisticated sing-along. It's like a sing-along that if Beethoven was going to try his hand
right.
at pop music that he would have written. But you can and it sounds, it's gussied up because it has all of the classical music instrumentation and everything. Mm-hmm. But really, it's the drums, it's the voice. I mean, is there even any bass? You don't notice any bass.
Yeah.
And it's Lennon's chunka-chunka rhythm guitar for a lot of it.
It is. I want to go back to George Harrison, but one of my favorite parts is that acoustic part where he's just like da 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 da. He's just hammering that acoustic, and it just, there's not a lot of instruments happening just in the Beatles instruments in the band, but it gives it,
right.
it just feels so full, and you feel the momentum of it. But I want to go back to the Harrison thing that you were saying. So, like, I think it's really interesting to look at, you know, you've got Paul McCartney, who is he's got, I don't know if you, Harrison would call him a, I don't think you'd call him a threat, but he's obviously one of the biggest songwriters in the world, and Harrison is now a famous guitar player. But Harrison has got to know that Paul McCartney is freaking awesome at guitar too, and Paul McCartney is owning, you know, it's his song, so he's able to call the shots. And so for him to kind of, I would think it would feel like McCartney is cutting his legs out every time that George Harrison is trying to do something, and Paul McCartney's like, no, that's not good, and you have to do it. Like, you can't tell McCartney no when he, you know, on like a song like this. Like, he had to back off from his idea. I would think that would be tough to swallow as a lead guitar player, that your ideas keep getting shot down. You know what I mean? Like, relationally, I think that would be tough.
He was turned loose a lot, though. Like, I mean, there's a ton of George Harrison guitar solos in the Beatles, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They did seem to defer to him. They let him have, like, the plum. When they did a cover, right? Like, in Montal Thalia's two guitar solos.
Yeah.
But McCartney, and they weren't doing, like, tons of overdubs at the time, but he didn't say, like, okay, like, I want to do this. Like, I mean, it was kind of like, you're the cleanup hitter. I'm the leadoff guy.
Right.
I'm the shortstop. I'm the best. But, you know, you're also the pitcher. I'm not the pitcher. I'm the shortstop. You pitch. That's your job. I think they looked at it really that way. Now, there were times when Harrison technically might not have been able to play something. And that sounds misleading, because there would have been things that Harrison could have played better than McCartney that he probably did play.
Totally.
because he played that better. But like McCartney was better suited to the Taxman guitar solo.
Yeah.
So that becomes like the example, right? But I don't know. Is the best guitar playing on Taxman not the fills at the end?
Right.
And that's Harrison.
Yeah, so, that's true. That's true.
Right. So why didn't McCartney, why was that divvied up? Why did that go back to Harrison? Mm. Maybe it's just the one could play the one better and the one could play the other better. Now, just the nature of this composition, we've talked about this before, and it's just how it works out. The Beatles' best songs tend not to have any need for a guitar solo. And yeah. You'd be like, oh, like Hendrix, but it's not a shortcoming of a song if it needs a guitar solo. But I would say a transcendent song often does not need one.
Oh, yeah.
Like a Rolling Stone doesn't need a guitar solo. She Loves You,
yeah.
A Day in the Life.
Yeah.
To me, I don't think it's really close. The three best Beatles songs are She Loves You, A Day in the Life, and Hey Jude. And there is not a guitar solo in any of them, right?
Yeah. So,
now there are other like top level. It doesn't mean the other songs aren't like top level songs. A Hard Day's Night is a great song, and I Want to Hold Your Hand is another one that doesn't have a guitar solo. And so,
true. Then you've got great ones like Let It Be. Let It Be does have it, but it doesn't need it,
right,
necessarily.
I think that the album version of Let It Be, which has just one of the, I don't know, one of their three or four, two, I don't know, best guitar solos, that
yeah.
Harrison one where he's turned loose with the distortion.
It's great.
I think that works so well on that song because it pumps the devil into the mix.
Yeah, it
not
adds
like the
something.
Actual devil, but
right.
but you have, I don't like things that are just all sacred, and I don't like things that are all profane, and I don't like things that are all serious or things that are all funny, because I think those things only achieve their maxed out power in relationship to their inverse, right? That's why the Pogues were like, oh, the sacred and profane, they go together.
Hmm.
And something that is truly funny also has a sobering element to it as well.
That's true.
So you get that churchified Let It Be, and then you have this cranking guitar solo, over-loud guitar solo. It's like a lot louder than the rest of the song.
It is.
Quite unusual.
Yeah.
But there's just no place for it on Hey Jude. They might as well have given the guy a tambourine and then like, right? Just like
add something,
because
George.
That had as much musical relevance.
That's true.
In
the
song. And
yeah.
Then you can sing at, and we'll talk about this, but there's that the video of them doing the quasi live version of this,
yeah,
on the David Frost program. And so the backing track is mostly just pre-recorded. McCartney's vocal is not pre-recorded, and they really nail to the visual aspect of that first word, because there's a tight close-up on his
yeah,
face
there,
and
is.
You get that hey, and his voice looks, his face looks exactly like the face of someone who would deliver that syllable that hangs in the air.
That's true.
And Harrison, I like, the camera's hardly ever on him the entire time,
right?
Like, it must suck for him. And there's not like, he's kind of like faking being happy, and there's not a lot, and it's just, but it's a weird setup too, because Lennon, I've never seen anything like this. So Lennon is on in this video, and you can watch this on YouTube.
Yep.
And he's on this high stool, like the high stool,
yep,
that one of them would sit on when they premiered a song for like the other half of the songwriting partnership in George Martin. And McCartney is lower than him, and Lennon, I mean, this is what I mean by the whole homoerotic thing. Lennon's staring at him the whole time, like he's romancing him, right? He's just...
They are looking at each other.
They're eyeball to eye. Like, it's very intimate. It's
yeah,
like there's some kind of love duet going on, and it's like this public display of affection or something.
That's
funny. They're trying to exchange something in their looks, and it's never written about, it's never talked about. Lennon's vocal is turned down a little bit, but they do the duet, but it's on the studio version. And I'd say out of all the music we've ever talked about, the Beatles, certainly, this song has, and it's about 30 seconds long, the greatest 30 seconds in the history of the Beatles discography, and it's not Dakota.
What is it? What do you think it is?
It is the duet between Lennon and McCartney. Mm. It is their best duet, and it's their most musically accomplished duet. It is like it's like the sanctus portion of the Mass before the consecration that's going to come with the coda, the complete giving over to Christ. And now one need not be religious to hear what I mean by that. One can be an atheist and still know what a consecration is, the idea of fully immersing yourself in something else. What that is for you, I don't know. Maybe it's God, maybe it's truth, maybe it's beauty, maybe it's fireball whiskey. Who knows? But there's something that I think we need to have as that fulcrum in our lives. And it's this hallowed, holy moment when these two people, as characters in this song, reconnect. And they have this duet. And we've spoken before, there are not a lot of duets in the Beatles canon. There's another great one that still awaits, the last one on the Ballad of John and Yoko, when it's just McCartney and Lennon by themselves without the other two.
Yep.
So it makes sense that they'd also have this kind of private, loving moment. And Two of Us is still out there, and If I Fell had already happened, but they do a lot of lead vocal and harmony singing. They do very few duets. Mm. The duet is like...
That's true.
If they're doing a duet, what they're saying to you is, this matters a great deal. Underline this. Boldface it. Because this isn't something we turn to very often.
In what part is that? What part of the song specifically? What words are we talking?
We're talking when it's the final lead up to the complete... the orgastic notion. I mean, you can see why a teenager boy would like this song. It's very much like orgastic and onanistic in structure, with this building moment of release. And so Lennon joins with McCartney, and he comes in because you don't expect it. McCartney's singing, and Lennon joins him on like the back half of a syllable. It's not like this line.
I know what you're talking about.
Okay,
okay.
Now it's like duet time. It's like, wait, did I just get some echo? Like, you're not aware of what it is. Quite at first, it's almost like you're sitting there like singing, I'm coming in like a little bit after, right? Like, we're not really doing it, but maybe like you keep going, then I'll get a little more into it, and then like before you know it, we're rocking as we go down the highway. So that's what happens here, and it's always like a little misaligned, a little off. It's like very believable and realistic that way. It's Lennon doing this kind of accentuation, but it's not harmony singing, because he's right there with him in a way that you have to be mentally there with somebody. You have to know what their cadences are going to be. You're going to have to know the way in which they're going to follow up this hard syllable with a slightly softer syllable, so you can be right there on the beat with them. And then they build and they build together. Again, this, it's sexual in some ways, and it's building, and it's homoerotic, because it's two guys, it's two male voices, and then it just becomes this crescendo, this orgastic scream from both. It's simultaneous orgasm between two people. It's this leap off the mountain type of moment, and then it's nah. It's like, okay,
there
yeah,
it is.
All right, you win.
Man.
So it's not just like building the song, come to this kind of moment. They're adding things along the way, and this is like the ultimate weapon. And then you have these two guys with this joint scream. It's almost like in Twist and Shout. McCartney's the one. Lennon screams the entire vocal, but the big scream on that piece of music is from McCartney when it comes back for the final verse. Most people think that's Lennon. It's McCartney.
That's
and then
awesome.
Lennon starts doing his thing again. But they're misaligned there. They're like completely in different like times.
Right.
Here, they're doing the same thing at the same time. They're screaming the same way. They are in throes together.
Yep.
It is just this incredibly emotionally intense moment of vulnerability and sort of denuded machismo. And it's just this virility and this homoerotic quality and the true love of... I don't think there's a more potent connection in this world than friendship. And that doesn't mean that, like, okay, these Bert and Ernie are, like, closer than, like, husband and wife. It means that there is, for the husband and wife and the relationships that work the best, an underpinning of a friendship. When you write a great work, it's an act of friendship between you and the reader. You're connected. You don't know each other. You've done that for them, and they're reading it for them, and it's facilitating their growth. It's vulnerability to help somebody else, and that's really being a person for others and growing at the same time is what friendship's about. Mm. And this, to me, is the sound of it, and it's the most thrilling half minute in I don't know, maybe the history of recorded sound. I don't know. It's up there.
That is awesome. You know, you talk about friendship, and like one of the stories I like about this song is when Paul was writing the song and the first time he played it for John, and he's singing the lyrics, and he gets to the line, "The movement you need is on your shoulder," and he turns over to him and says, I'll change that, don't worry about it." And John stops and says, "You won't, you know." That's what he said. That's like the best line in the song. That seems like such a affirming moment between those two. You know, when McCartney, I think, had always probably looked up to Lennon as the older songwriter, mentor, even at the beginning, at the very beginning, but that kind of human moment between those two, where he's like, "No, what you did is great there. You know, don't change a thing." I love the visual of that, imagining them in a room talking about this song that we love so much.
It's a Lennon type line.
It is.
So you can see why he would. So like, it's not a line that McCartney would write a line like that. I mean, it makes sense to just as a placeholder. I'll get rid of this later. It's not. He didn't really, with the exception of Eleanor Rigby, right? Wearing a face that she keeps in a glass jar by the door, or whatever it is. He doesn't really do that kind of fanciful.
Yeah, that's
imagery.
True. Yeah,
he's very just social realist, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Some of it's Moon June early on, but. These are not the things of Jean Cocteau, which is more Lennon's arena.
Yeah.
So that was, I think it also speaks to, this probably happened all the time. This is like a famous example of it, but I bet you it happened all the time. And I bet you when they weren't together and they didn't have the system of checks and balances, we've spoken about this before. It bothers me a lot that both of these guys did nothing once they went away from each other. And I know people want to say like Wings and Band on the Run and all of that, but the Beatles would have rejected that music.
I think so.
They wouldn't
too.
Have been like, let's make this a single. They'd be like, oh, that's fine for like the Hollies, right?
Yeah.
They that wouldn't have been like up to their level. And you just wonder like that kind of attrition of not having someone to say no to you,
right?
Or say, you know what? I know you've worked your ass off on this, but maybe you could work like a little bit more, right? Like that, and I think just over time, then that builds in bad habits. And when you can just when you can just rely on craftsmanship, right? You're not. I mean, Picasso got to a point in his life when he's made all this money, he ceases to innovate.
Mm-hmm.
That is fine, right? He can do this pastiche of what he's done before, and you see it in music too. People don't want to really like think about Picasso. Like you see it with Eric Clapton.
Mm-hmm.
People are like, "Oh, it's 1968. I'm done innovating." Right? I mean, you can play the head of the guitar,
right?
But he never innovated again.
Uh-uh.
Like he's with Cream, and then he's like he's going to do Layla, and then he just autopilots.
Yeah.
So I think like you have that moment here of like, this is somebody saying, "Hey, no, I know this isn't your comfort zone, man. It's more my comfort zone."
Yeah.
I'm writing, when he wrote "I Am the Walrus," he wrote a line a day from the typewriter. He's like, "Oh, I'll just come by, pop out a line." And that's like part of the reason that it goes together. And so he was able to say, "No, trust that, go with that. It's good." And it's almost like a Zen cone. It is like, you wouldn't want, if you were McCartney, to go to that well too often. It's not really a strong suit.
No.
But here it works with the, because lullabies, again, they're fanciful. They're not social realism. They're things that blackbirds do and tuck you into bed and all that weirdness of lullabies, the dream world of lullabies. And you see it on Cry Baby Cry on the White Album. It's a lullaby song. Cry
Great song.
Baby Cry.
Yeah.
Like it's, again, it's a minor key. It's haunting. But it's not to give you nightmares, but it's really not that far removed from where Hey Jude begins.
Man. And I think there's so much, you and I land in such a similar spot on the solo Beatles careers, at least John and Paul. Like, I always, you know, compare it to the further they got from the breakup, not the worst they got, but like it's like they were untethered. And I think a lot of times when you get around, you know, famous, you know, you get to be a famous artist and everybody is applauding you. And then you can surround yourself with people who are like, oh, that's great. And you don't have somebody like a Lennon or a McCartney who's going to say, that's pretty good. But if you thought about this, you know,
it speaks to purpose. I mean, purpose is a rare quality in life. To have it at any point in life, what most people are going to do is find somebody, breed, their kids are going to be their life, right? Then hopefully it works out for the kids, they have grandkids, they die. I don't view that as like purpose. Purpose is something completely different. It impels you out of bed at 4 in the morning. That makes you think, you know what? I created a masterpiece yesterday. Mm. I haven't created any today. Do I suck now, or can I be better?
Right.
Because I don't want to live off of Wednesday when it's Thursday.
Yeah.
And I think the most people usually will have, very rare people, one out of many millions, will have that for a period of years. You see it at successful NFL coaches, right? Then they get a bunch of yes men around them. But they're also not driving themselves the same way. Mm. And that's why you have these artists, and they have this period in time when they tended to do what they did. And that's always been something that I've never wanted to be that way personally. And I don't think that's my own makeup, certainly. And I always, one of the examples I think of is like the Beatles thing. Like, these guys, they had by far, they had like 2/3 of their life in front of them, like in theory. And it's just like, that would have made me feel awful. Like people asking me about something I wrote in 1968.
Oh, right.
And it's like 1987.
Yes.
That would have made me feel. But they were always able to talk about it.
Yeah.
But I would have. That really would have eaten into my self-esteem.
I think so too.
I would have struggled with that. And McCartney and Ringo is obviously easier for Ringo Starr to just, right, give his little peace sign. Can't see a photo of him without that. But McCartney was somebody who had, to put it in a different context, he had the melodic gifts of a Schubert, like Franz Schubert. Like he really had a melodic streak at that level. There's certain people, like Beethoven wasn't a great melody guy. He was almost sort of like Dylan wasn't a great melody guy in rock. But he could have like "I Want You," and that's really melodic. But it wasn't his strength. But certain people, Schubert in classical music, Handel, and then McCartney—they're just like the main melodic guys. And that was a curse in some ways, I feel like, for him, because he could tumble out of bed and do that and write a tune. And he wasn't reaching. For connectivity. And that's a lot different than a tune. Connecting with someone is when you, to buttonhole somebody is to grab them by the lapels and pull them like closer to you and put your face in their face. And that's what great art does. It's on one side of the table and the audience is on the other side of the table, and it buttonholes the audience. And the Beatles, they buttonholed the hell out of you, and then they weren't in the Beatles, and that didn't really happen anymore.
Right.
And we had spoken before about Abbey Road and how that wasn't so much a collection of songs, and who knows if that was just the way it was trending at the time too, and if they'd stayed together, maybe that's how it would have been if there was a Beatles album in 1972. Because you get it with the Stones remain good really up until 72, right?
Yeah.
And then they have moments.
Yeah.
And maybe they have a whole album almost at the moment, or they have like pieces of an album. But the run, The Beggar's Banquet, Let It Bleed, Sticky Fingers, even though that was a hodgepodge, Exile, Aftermath, look how well Aftermath holds together.
Right.
They didn't have that in them after a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
And they were in some ways more driven, I think, after a certain point than the Beatles, because they must have really wanted to keep going.
I think so,
too. It would have been so much easier for them not to. Like,
just quit.
They had to have just been so, like, driven, right? Even now. Like,
they're still doing it.
77 yesterday?
Man.
And still, that's a lot of drive. And it's not like they need the money.
Right. I went and saw them last summer, and it was one of my favorite shows I've ever seen. And I was went in with like zero expectation. I'm like, I'm just going to be able to say I saw this. And I was blown away with like the energy. Like, to your point, they had to, you have to want it to still be going to all that trouble to go out and do this thing. We talked about this briefly on one of the previous podcasts, but you brought up the moment where McCartney shows up to the Stones release party, basically, of Beggar's Banquet. And he's holding the acetate of Hey Jude, and he's like, hey, why don't you put this on?
Yeah, so everybody's rocking out to Beggar's Banquet. Now, I don't think Beggar's Banquet is the Stones' best album, but it's kind of like their Hard Day's Night. And what I mean by that is it doesn't sound anything like a Hard Day's Night, but a Hard Day's Night is the Beatles' most perfect album. Like, there's just nothing wrong with it. And Beggar's Banquet, there's nothing wrong with it, right? You can't really pick a fault with a song or the way something's recorded. Like, all of it is just on point, and it was just rocking out this joint. Somebody's, I don't know, record studio party or whatever it might have been. I think it was like a house.
Yeah.
And McCartney's there, and he has the little metal disc, the acetate, and he's like, oh, why don't you put this on? It's like a new one. Now it's going to be good. and they put it on. And it starts in such a way, too, that it's like, it stops everything happening around it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I think when I told you that story, I didn't really get into that aspect of it, because right from that, again, that first note, it's the type of thing that makes you halt your conversation with the person next to you.
You know everybody
stopped. It's the baton. It's the baton in the air. It's Christmas carols at King's College, right? You know how, like, it's very much a Christmas carol song.
Yeah.
The way it's orchestrated. That's and the sing-along chorus. And it has like a folk. It's this marriage of folk music and classical music.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a ditty. It's a sing-along ditty. And you listen to, like, God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, this is kind of like classical, works in the classical setting, but it's almost like also something that some vagrant, like a tramp, could sing on his travels. You know what I mean? Like folksy. It's Good King Wenceslas, which the Beatles would drunkenly riff on in the 1963 flexi disc fan club Christmas release. It's classical and it's folksy. This isn't that far removed from their drunken warbling of the 1963 flexi disc, which is another like really fun thing to listen to.
Yes,
but so right when you get that it was like the sort of like seize the day kind of song to upstage somebody, because with one syllable you're going, it's like like really loud, powerful. Psst. Like if you're out in the street and you hear someone yell to the person next to you, "Hey!"
Yeah.
Like you're gonna be like, "Hey, what's up?"
Yeah.
Like here comes trouble. It's like, oh no, hands out of the pockets. Like you don't know, and so then you're hooked right away. You're listening right away, and Jagger was pissed, and I'm like, what are you going to do? But they also have this great competition.
Right.
And I could see how if you were the Stones after a certain point, you'd be like, well, they were better at some things, but we've also won some things here too. We're still going. They haven't existed in 2 or 3 years and we're putting out Exile, and this is where we're at, having this great world tour, and we just seem to be getting tighter all the time with Mick Taylor.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's in some ways closer. It's almost like when you talk about Hall of Fame players in baseball. And you look at like a Sandy Koufax, and he's in the Hall of Fame for 5 years, his peak. We talk about prime, we talk about peak, we talk about career stats. And the Stones have like a really good prime, and they have the career stats because they've done this forever. The Beatles just were peak. It's like, we will win the MVP for 9 years in a row. like Wayne Gretzky,
hands
like
down.
A higher peak than everybody. But it was so concentrated. Yeah. It wasn't diffuse.
Right. It's like the Bulls. Do you think the Stones knew that the Beatles were better?
I think that they thought they were better songwriters, yeah. I don't think that they thought they were a better rock and roll band.
Okay.
I think
I agree.
For a lot of these groups, and we talked about with Pete Townsend, the Who, he thought the Beatles were terrible as a band.
Right.
Which, if you listen to the Washington Coliseum show we've talked about, or the October '63 Swedish material, or the first Shea Stadium. It's a great. I wrote something, I think, for Rolling Stone about how if you release this, it would be one of the all time best live albums. And then, of course, the end all be all with this argument clincher is the BBC recordings, mm-hmm. the 1963 BBC recordings in particular. But I think the Stones thought that they were more of a kick-ass rock and roll band, could do more things and could stretch out. And you listen to Get Your Yah Yahs out, right? I mean, they weren't the Grateful Dead, but they'd improvise. You'd get something different from night to night. They got Mick Taylor in the band, and I think to the Stones themselves, when they got Mick Taylor, that was a free agent acquisition, like getting Frank Robinson in his prime. This is a main superstar stud who raised the band to... Brian Jones had the eclectic interests and gave the sounds different flavors and everything, and Keith Richards did his riff stuff and was more of a writer who was a rhythm guitarist who could play a bit of lead. But I think when they got Mick Taylor, they got that level of player who is good enough to be a jazz musician.
Yeah.
Right? There aren't a Ginger, but everybody in Cream was that way. Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker, they had their background. They got a guy like that that could just play. I mean, Mick Taylor could have been a classical guitarist.
Yeah.
He was technically just leaks beyond all of these people. So yeah, I think that's what they thought. But they probably also thought it was a silly comparison because they did such different things.
Right. I mean, they're both rock bands, but they're so different. I mean, they're incredibly different when you look at the nuance of all the things that both of them did, both their catalogs. They really spread in different ways.
Look at other bands like the Beach Boys and the Byrds. Those might be the two best American bands. Velvet Underground maybe, but they're in there, and you think in some ways, the Beach Boys, I don't even think of them as a rock and roll band, and I don't mean genre. I just mean that, yes, they're live recordings, and they're not as bad as people say, but they pieced a lot of it together in the studio.
Right.
They were I don't want to say Brian Eno, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, there's just an element of that.
Yes.
Okay, we'll do some of this on this particular track, and we'll do this on this track, and almost being these sonic wizards.
Yeah.
More than an organic, okay, we got the backing track. Nice bass part there. Although, obviously, there was parts of it. Then you think of the Byrds, and they're doing these futuristic, crazy, sophisticated things. But for a while, you almost kind of thought of them as the California Monkees, right?
Mm, yeah,
They weren't like this. Now, they're doing the Untitled album in 1970. And then they have the country and western aspect in 68, and they have the hot guitar parts and all that, but not 65, 66. You had the feeling that if they made it all the way through a song without screwing up, and there's actually live recordings from the radio in Stockholm that are quite good, that sort of give the lie to this theory. But you don't think of them as they're just this sort of tough, we can play anyone off the stage type of rock and roll band. And
right.
I think that was the Stones thing. And it's something that people devalue or they underrate about the Beatles.
Yeah.
I think the Beatles and the Battle of the Bands in terms of whipping people up into a froth were they're just the best band that way. I think they were the best as a band in that sense. Not to stretch out and we've talked about the long version of Live of My Generation from Live at Leeds to the Dead or anything like that. But just boom, you have 12 minutes on the stage tonight, boys, to wow the people here. And you're
show
going,
what you got.
Yeah, I think the Beatles would take all comers.
I don't disagree one bit. You and I were talking about energy last week and in last week's episode, and I started, thinking the end of the song, just for me, the energy level goes through the roof. And so when I was reading about some of the stuff that was happening, apparently when they started the actual track for this recording, Ringo wasn't even in the room. He had slipped out to go to the bathroom. So the band starts the actual recording while he's in the bathroom. He comes back in time for the drums. So you can imagine the tension in the room. What is Ringo coming back? And then when they get to recording the strings, and tell me if you know about this, but apparently I guess it was a giant string section, and McCartney starts getting mad, and he's like, I need energy. And he at one point gets on top of the piano and he's conducting the orchestra from on top of a piano. And he's angry because he's like, I need some friggin' energy to this song because he's put so much into it. I think that is such a cool visual, trying to get those classically trained musicians to bust out and show some passion and some feeling and energy.
Well, it's not even passion and energy. The thing is, if you're a classical musician, you are sticking to the score.
The notes.
It's utterly foreign to you that you're taking your cue from the conductor. The conductor, William Furtwängler, is the auteur. He's the Orson Welles of the piece. So when they wanted, like, on A Day in the Life, it's like, okay, you can play this, but just make sure you use these notes at some point and then just keep going. These guys were baffled. That's not their skill set.
Right.
It's just not what they do. You can't. It's in a way you're asking these people to improvise.
Yeah.
And you can't do that. It's not jazz. It's a very different discipline. It's a different way. It's like asking a figure skater to just start playing hockey or vice versa, however you want to. Look, just because you can skate really well doesn't mean it's like, all right, I'm in the NHL, baby.
Right.
It doesn't work that way. And I think the energy is in this. It's a building energy song. It's a song that has immediate insta energy with that first note, but it's not going to give all the energy at once.
Mm-hmm.
She Loves You gives all the energy at once.
That's true.
A song like this, or I Am the Stone Roses, I Am the Resurrection, it builds. It's like each time, when I hear I Am the Resurrection, I think of a band that's a gang, and they're going down one block. And at the end of each block, they pick up more members to march with them. They get to the next one, more members. And it builds and builds and builds until eventually it's kind of like, wow, there are a lot of people walking down this road.
Right.
I don't know how well this is going to go for me as I try to take them on. And then it topples over and it explodes into this chorus of, I'm the resurrection and I am the life. Now, if you're going to have that as like your lyric, your big chorus, you need to set that up in a huge way to be able to pull off such a huge conceit like that. And I think that's a similar idea that's happening in this song. But if you listen to like the first take of this song, they knew exactly what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is now, it's pretty much there from the first take.
That's true.
Including, like, they don't do the duet, but you know where it's going to come in.
Hmm.
And McCartney's singing, like, he knows how he's going to sing it later. And a huge part of this performance is going to be his vocal. His vocal is tasked with a lot of responsibility. Not just like, oh, sing this really well. But it has to have this range to it.
Yeah.
It's going to be his song that displays the full, maybe not the full, but the greatest quotient of his range, right? Like, it's going to have the Little Richard, Ooh My Soul type of stuff from his early Hamburg and BBC days. It's going to have his, like, lower note type of Bullfrog stuff. It's going to cover the entire gamut. So you would have to be somebody who... No, this one, like, this is a tough song. I know there are, like, some okay versions, but it's a tough song to cover. You have to take a completely different approach to it because he just had this instrument that was going to, it was really well written, but it's not going to work. It's like Mozart. He'd write these amazing, like, woodwind pieces, but he wrote them for specific people that he knew could play them really well.
Hmm.
McCartney wrote this for his voice because he knew that, I'll be able to do this.
Right.
I can sing this really well. I'm asking a lot of myself, but when you listen to like his extemporizations on the coda, he never repeats himself.
Yeah.
It would be so easy because it's just like stat singing. It's like nonsense.
Right.
It'd be so easy to screw that up, though.
Yeah.
Like, to not make it sound, like, for lack of a better word, cool,
mm-hmm.
or to not have like the right amount of syllables. No. Like, you need to have the right no. Like, if you leave one out, it sounds weird.
Right.
And the track can break down at that point. Like, he had to finesse all of that shouting.
Yeah,
power.
That's right.
I mean, it's really almost mathematical.
Yeah.
Because you have this like 4-bar chorus, but you have to put in these extemporizations. You have to get in and get out, and the next round of the na-na-na start. And you're so deep into it at that point, you don't want to, like, screw it up. That wouldn't feel very... Like, can you overdub, like, this part where you just sort of go nuts here?
Right.
Like, it has to be, like, in the moment.
Yep.
So there was... It really speaks to how well he could sing live, too,
right,
and think as a singer as he sang live.
And he just puts out that feeling, and then to your point from the earlier episode, authenticity. That's what, you know, it all sounds like he believes it, and the energy is there, and it's just so good.
Takes his cue from him, too. Some of the drum fills, if you listen carefully, they're, like, mimicking what McCartney's just done with his voice. And Starr's not doing that at first. He's doing that as he goes along.
That's true.
Because the enthusiasm is, like, being
building,
absorbed by him, too.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm into this now. Let's
right.
drum, baby.
Let's do this.
Like, I was late, but now I'm here. So, yeah, you have a lot. Everybody but poor George Harrison, right, is getting in on it by the end.
That's true. That's true. Well, Colin, man, I greatly, greatly appreciate you being on all five episodes this month, talking about the Beatles. Colin's book that he's working on is called Same Band You've Never Known, An Alternative Musical History of the Beatles. It has been an honor. I wish you the best in completing that book, and would love to have you on at some point in the future to talk about it.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you, Colin. Thanks for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Leave a rating and review so others can find the podcast as well.